I want to thank you very much for your kind introduction, and it was worth the entire $50 that I gave you. I am truly honored to be here this evening. I'm actually more humbled than honored to participate in the Abraham Lecture Series. Your kind invitation to me is perhaps one of the most meaningful invitations, I would say the most meaningful speaking engagement during my professional career. Why might I say that? I say that because the individual for whom this lecture series has been named, Henry J. Abraham, is an extraordinary professor, an extraordinary teacher, and more important, an extraordinary human being. In the fall of 1976, when I was a student here at the university, I had the privilege of attending his class on constitutional law. Believe it or not, I still have my textbook and I still have my notes. I may put them on eBay and make some money. But Professor Abraham ignited my passion for constitutional law, and he inspired me to work hard, and he inspired me to pursue a legal education. He told me, quote, "Don't be like me, don't practice law without a license." He was also kind enough to write a letter of recommendation for me, when I applied to law school both here and at the Harvard Law School. What does this mean? This means that whenever I write an opinion or dissent that involves the First Amendment and you like it, give the accolades to Professor Abraham. More importantly, though, from my perspective, whenever I write a First Amendment opinion or dissent that you dislike, likewise, blame Professor Abraham. And that part's really important. I also thank the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression, and I also thank Bob O'Neill for the center's outstanding work to protect the freedoms guaranteed by this most important amendment that from time to time we take for granted. This evening, I would like to have a conversation with you about a story. A rather strange story of constitutional interpretation involving three cases that commenced in Virginia's circuit courts. These cases traveled throughout Virginia's judicial system and ultimately became the subject of the Supreme Court of the United States opinion in Virginia versus Barry Black, Richard Elliott, and Jonathan O'Mara. I have entitled this story, Virginia versus Black, a strange twist in First Amendment jurisprudence. We can all acknowledge from our personal experiences that the activities of the Ku Klux Klan, as well as acts of cross-burning with no Klan involvement, have been a part of Virginia's history. I can recall on numerous occasions as a child traveling throughout Virginia and North Carolina with my parents and grandparents, encountering large and small groups of people clothed with white hoods and white gowns gathered around huge burning crosses. And as I speak, I still visualize my parents telling me as a young child, "Don't look out of that window of the car." And just as vividly, I can remember doing what any child 7, 8, or 9 years old would do, I looked more and I stared intently. However, I realized pretty quickly from the noise of the crowd and the fear on my parents' faces that the burning of the crosses was certainly not an invitation to have dinner among friends. And even at that young age, I knew that the act of burning a cross was an expression of racial and religious bigotry, usually directed, but not always, towards people of color or people who hailed from other countries. A cursory search of Virginia's major newspapers from 1949 through 1951 reveals numerous incidences of cross burnings in our Commonwealth. The Sunday, January 23, 1949 edition of the Richmond Times-Dispatch reports, and I quote, "Crossfire near Suffolk stirs probe. Burning in second week. Virginia's cross-burning episode of the week was under investigation yesterday by the Nasmith County law enforcement officers. A six-foot wooden cross was burned Friday night in front of a store owned by Alvesta Drake, a Negro." Continuing the quote, "The incident followed by less than 24 hours the burning of the cross on the front yard of J.M. Sweat, a Negro school teacher living in a predominantly white residential section of Richmond. J. Frank Culpepper, Nasmith County Sheriff, said only a few persons apparently set up and lit the cross near Drake's store. Culpepper said the cross burners arrived at the store in two cars and left immediately after setting the flames." End of quote. The April 14, 1950 edition of the Richmond Times-Dispatch reports, quote, "A huge cross, reminiscent of the Ku Klux Klan days, was burned atop a hill just south of Covington County last night. Hugh D. Little of Suffolk, one of nine men questioned by the sheriff, assumed responsibility for the cross burning. The sheriff said the burning of the cross was an initiation ceremony for a secret organization chartered by the State Corporation Commission," end of quote. The February 26, 1951 edition of the Richmond Times-Dispatch also reported, and I quote, "A six-foot cross was burned in front of the home of a Negro family in the center of a small Goochland community shortly before 10 o'clock p.m. Saturday night. It was the third such cross to be burned in this vicinity within the past week," authorities said. "Two of the crosses were burned in Goochland County, and the third cross in the western section of Henrico County. The latest cross was burned in front of the home of John Pittman, owner of a small tavern on State Route 6, about 11 miles west of Richmond. Pittman said he heard a commotion in the front of his home Saturday night. When he went to the front door, the cross was blazing. He said he saw five or six white men running away. They jumped into a car parked nearby and drove towards the Goochland County Courthouse. Pittman said one of the men stuck a pistol out of the window and fired five times." End of quote. Bill Hendrick, the Grand Dragon of a division of the Ku Klux Klan in Florida, had visited the city of Richmond in an effort to organize chapters of the Ku Klux Klan. Responding to reports of organized Ku Klux Klan activity in certain parts of Virginia, Governor John Battle Sr., whose son later served on the board of this center, decided to support the legislation that would prohibit activities sponsored by the Klan and cross-burning in Virginia. Governor Battle had received reports that the Ku Klux Klan was trying to organize in Virginia, and he desired to prevent terrorist activities by that organization. Ultimately, the General Assembly of Virginia enacted Code Section 18.2423, which was sponsored by then a former legislator who ultimately became governor, Governor Godwin. That statute states, and I quote, "It shall be unlawful for any person or persons with the intent of intimidating any person or group of persons to burn or cause to be burned a cross on the property of another. Any person who violates this provision shall be guilty of a Class 6 felony." We then fast forward to 1998. Two different instances of cross burning occurred in 1998 that formed the factual basis for the three cases that would ultimately reach the United States Supreme Court. The first case involves Barry Elton Black, a member of the Ku Klux Klan. I remember one of my law clerks telling me it's very strange that a member of the Klan would have a last name Black. On August 22, 1998, the sheriff of Carroll County received a telephone call, and he was informed that members of the Ku Klux Klan intended to conduct a rally in Carroll County that evening. The rally was to be held on property owned by Annabelle Sechrist. She had given the Klan permission to burn the cross on her property, and she did, in fact, attend the rally. The sheriff and his deputies drove their cruisers to the site of the rally, where three men dressed in white robes and white hats approached him. 45 minutes after the rally started, the sheriff observed the Klan members burn a cross that was approximately 25 to 35 feet tall. The sheriff approached Barry Black, and the sheriff said, "Who's responsible for burning this cross?" And Black responded, "I am." The sheriff then said, "You're under arrest." Rebecca Sechrist lived on property adjacent to the location of the rally, and she watched the rally from a window inside of her house. I imagine, but I am not sure, that she was related to Annabelle Sechrist, who owned the property where the rally occurred. Rebecca Sechrist heard members of the rally utter the word "nigger." And she said a member of the Klan stated that the Mexicans were bad, and one got up and said that he would like to take a .30-30 caliber rifle and just randomly shoot the Blacks. And she stated, quote, "They talked about how they would like to send the Blacks and the Mexicans back to where they come from," end of quote. She stated she was frightened, and she testified at Black's subsequent trial that the members of the Klan were, quote, "trying to scare her," end of quote. Black was indicted by a Carroll County grand jury for the burning of a cross with the intent to intimidate in violation of Code Section 18.2423 that we mentioned previously. At the conclusion of a trial, the jury found him guilty and fixed his punishment at $2,500. Black appealed the circuit court judgment to the Court of Appeals, which affirmed his conviction. The other incident of cross burning that occurred in 1998 involved two young men in Virginia Beach, Jonathan O'Mara and Richard Elliott. In May of 1998, Jonathan O'Mara, Richard Elliott, and 13 other persons were at a social gathering where they drank alcoholic beverages. O'Mara expressed his disdain because a neighbor had complained to O'Mara's parents regarding O'Mara's acts of shooting pistols in his parents' backyard. Someone in the group said, "Let's get them. Let's burn a cross in their yard." O'Mara agreed. The men, with the assistance of O'Mara's friend, David Targi, built a cross. They got in the truck. They traveled to the neighbor's house. They placed the cross in the neighbor's yard. They poured an accelerant on the cross. They ignited the cross, and the men left. The following morning, the neighbors found the partially burned and charred cross in their yard, and they called the police. O'Mara was indicted by a grand jury in the city of Virginia Beach for attempting to burn a cross with the intent of intimidating, in violation of Code Section 18.2.423, and he was also indicted for the conspiracy to burn a cross. O'Mara entered a guilty plea and reserved his right to file an appeal in which he would challenge the constitutionality of this code section. The court convicted O'Mara and sentenced him to 90 days in jail and imposed a fine of $2,500. O'Mara appealed the conviction to the Court of Appeals, which affirmed both convictions. Richard Elliott, O'Mara's cohort, was also indicted for attempting to burn a cross on the property of another with the intent to intimidate and conspiracy to burn a cross in violation of the same code section. At the conclusion of a jury trial, he was also convicted, and the jury fixed his punishment at 90 days incarceration in jail, and the jury assessed a fine of $2,500. Elliott appealed his conviction to the Court of Appeals, which also affirmed the conviction. One thing that I thought was interesting about the punishments that Black, Elliott, and O'Mara each received is that three different triers of fact all impose the same fine of $2,500. So there must be something mystical about that fee. Black, O'Mara, and Elliott all appeal their convictions to the Supreme Court of Virginia. The Supreme Court of Virginia, on a 4-3 vote, held that Virginia's cross-burning statute was unconstitutional. The majority consisted of Justice Lemons, Justice Lacey, Justice Kinzer, and Senior Justice Whiting invalidated the convictions. Ironically, Senior Justice Whiting participated in the appeals because Justice Kenan's husband, Judge Alan Rosenblatt, was one of the circuit court judges who decided one of the cases in Virginia Beach involving Elliott and O'Mara. Justice Lemons, writing for the majority, held that Virginia's cross-burning statute constituted impermissible government regulation of non-verbal symbolic expression. The majority applied the United States Supreme Court's decision in RAV versus City of St. Paul, and the majority concluded that Virginia's cross-burning statute was indistinguishable from an ordinance that the United States Supreme Court invalidated in its case RAV. The ordinance that the Supreme Court of the United States invalidated in RAV states, and I quote, "Whoever places on public or private property a symbol, object, appellation, characterization, or graffiti, including but not limited to a burning cross or a Nazi swastika, which one knows or had reasonable grounds to know arouses anger, alarm, or resentment in others on the basis of race, color, creed, religion, or gender, commits disorderly conduct and shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. Contrast the Virginia statute and the ordinance in RAV. The Virginia statute, number one, was a felony, and number two, the burning of the cross had to be done so with the intent to intimidate. In the City of St. Paul ordinance, however, the object that was offensive had to cause alarm or resentment in others on the basis of race, color, religion, or gender. And that is an important factor that I would like for you to keep in your mind. The Supreme Court of the United States explained in RAV, quote, "What we have here, it must be emphasized, is not a prohibiting of fighting words that are directed at certain persons or groups, but rather a prohibition of fighting words that contain messages of bias-motivated hatred, and in particular, messages based on virulent notions of racial supremacy." End of quote. The Supreme Court of Virginia's majority also invalidated the cross-burning statute because that statute states in part, quote, "Any burning of a cross shall be prima facie evidence of an intent to intimidate a person or groups of persons." End of quote. The Virginia Supreme Court majority held that the act of burning a cross alone with no evidence of intent to intimidate would be sufficient to support an arrest and a prosecution and would insulate the Commonwealth from a motion to strike the evidence at the end of the Commonwealth's case in chief. In a dissenting opinion, which I authored, I disagreed rather strongly with the conclusions of the majority of the Supreme Court of Virginia. I observed that Virginia's cross-burning statute does not, by its express terms, proscribe or prohibit every act of burning a cross. Rather, Virginia's cross-burning statute only prohibited acts of burning a cross when those acts were performed with the intent of intimidation. In Virginia's jurisprudence, the word intimidation means to place a victim, quote, "in fear of bodily harm." Such fear must arise from the willful conduct of the accused rather than some mere temperamental timidity of the victim. However, the fear of the victim need not be so great as to result in terror, panic, or hysteria. End of quote. I also disagreed with the Supreme Court of Virginia's majority's understanding of the United States Supreme Court's opinion in RAV. The United States Supreme Court's decision in RAV did not involve conduct intended to intimidate a victim. Finally, I asserted in my dissent that the provision in Virginia's cross-burning statute that provided that the burning of a cross shall be prima facie evidence of an intent to intimidate did not alone permit the finder of fact, the jury or the judge, to convict someone. The statute merely created an inference, and the Commonwealth was still required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person who burned the cross did so with the intent to intimidate a identifiable victim. The Commonwealth of Virginia appealed the judgment of the Supreme Court of Virginia to the United States Supreme Court, which granted cert and ultimately issued its many decisions in Virginia against Black. Justice O'Connor authored the opinion for the Supreme Court of the United States, and her opinion consisted of numerous parts. Chief Justice Rehnquist, Chief Justice Stevens, Justice Breyer, and Justice Scalia joined parts 1, 2, and 3 of her opinion. Part 1 of the opinion contains a statement of facts, which we need not repeat again. Part 2 of the opinion contains a history of the Ku Klux Klan and the origins of the practice of cross burning. For purposes of our discussion this evening, I note that in part 2 of its opinion, the Supreme Court wrote, and I quote, "Often, the cross burner intends that the recipients of the message fear for their lives. And when a burning cross is used to intimidate, few, if any, messages are more powerful." End of quote. In part 3 of the Supreme Court's opinion, which is a majority opinion, Justice O'Connor agreed with the proposition set forth in my dissent that the First Amendment does not prohibit a state from enacting statutes that prescribe the burning of a cross with the intent to intimidate. And the phrase intent to intimidate is very important. Distinguishing the Virginia statute from the ordinance that was the subject of its opinion in RAV, Justice O'Connor wrote, and I quote, "Virginia statute does not run afoul of the First Amendment insofar as it bans cross-burning with the intent to intimidate. Unlike the ordinance at issue in RAV, the Virginia statute does not single out for opprobrium only that speech directed towards one of the specified disfavored topics. It does not matter whether an individual burns a cross with the intent to intimidate because of the victim's race, gender, or religion, or because of the victim's political affiliation, union membership, or homosexuality. Moreover, as a factual matter, it is not true that cross burners direct their intimidating conduct solely to racial or religious minorities. Indeed, as in the case of Elliot and O'Mara, it is at least unclear whether the respondents burned a cross due to racial animus." Continuing to quote Justice O'Connor, "The First Amendment permits Virginia to outlaw cross burnings done with the intent to intimidate because burning a cross is a particularly virulent form of intimidation. Instead of prohibiting all intimidating messages, Virginia may choose to regulate this subset of intimidating messages in light of cross burning's long and pernicious history as a signal of impending violence. Just as a state may regulate only that obscenity which is most obscene due to its prurient content, so too may a state choose to prohibit only those forms of intimidation that are most likely to inspire fear of bodily harm. End of quote. In part 4 of Justice O'Connor's opinion, which is a plurality opinion, she noted that Virginia's cross-burning statute was unconstitutionally overbroad because of the provision that, quote, any such burning of a cross shall be prima facie evidence of an intent to intimidate a person or group of persons. And for those of you who are not lawyers, this statute means that the mere burning of a cross is sufficient evidence from which a jury or finder of fact may conclude that the cross was burned with the intent to intimidate. And that's what is meant by the word prima facie. Justice O'Connor stated, the prima facie evidence provision, as interpreted by the jury instruction, renders the statute unconstitutional. And I'm going to repeat this sentence because it's pretty important. The prima facie evidence provision, as interpreted by the jury instruction, renders the statute unconstitutional. I'm continuing the quote. Because this jury instruction is the model jury instruction, and because the Supreme Court of Virginia had the opportunity to expressly disavow the jury instruction, the jury instruction's construction of the prima facie provision is a ruling on a question of state law that is binding on us, even though the precise words have not been written in the statute. As construed by the jury instruction, the prima facie provision strips away the very reason why a state may ban cross burning with the intent to intimidate. What does this quote mean to those of you who are not lawyers? It means the following. It means that the plurality opinion, and the plurality opinion means that a majority of the court did not embrace the opinion, but 4 people did. The jury instruction was used to discern the meaning of the statute. And so the plurality took the statute in one hand, it took the jury instruction in the other hand. It combined the two, and the plurality said that the jury instruction, when read with the statute, rendered the statute unconstitutional for First Amendment purposes. And it's very important that we understand what the plurality did. Now, I have very serious analytical concerns with the plurality's analysis. Why? How can a jury instruction, which was never approved by any Virginia government, be deemed action of the Commonwealth of Virginia? And the Virginia Model Jury Instruction book, in which this instruction is found, contains the following note. Quote, the Supreme Court of Virginia and the Court of Appeals of Virginia have neither adopted or approved this publication. Hence, the entire premise upon which the plurality of the Supreme Court of the United States relied to invalidate the statute is an incorrect premise. Furthermore, the legal principle that a jury instruction can be used to render a statute unconstitutional is fraught with potential mischief. If a jury instruction can be used to invalidate a statute and thereby render the statute void for purposes of the First Amendment, is the opposite true? If a statute is facially invalid, can a jury instruction be given to a jury that will render that same statute constitutionally permissible? Furthermore, why should a citizen's First Amendment rights be predicated upon whether a judge, on some future date, during some future unknown trial, grant or refuse to grant a jury instruction? And what if the jury instruction had never been given? If the jury instruction had never been given, would the statute have been deemed constitutionally permissible? The plurality's concept, in my humble and respectful opinion, confuses rather than aids the development of First Amendment jurisprudence. Justice Scalia noted this point in his dissent when he stated, quote, "Perhaps more alarming, the plurality concedes that its understanding of the prima facie evidence provision is premised on jury instructions given in respondent Black's case. This would be all well and good were it not for the fact that the plurality facially invalidates the Virginia statute." Continuing his quote, Justice Scalia says, "I am aware of no case, and the plurality cites none, in which the United States Supreme Court has facially invalidated an ambiguous statute on the basis of a constitutionally troublesome jury instruction. And it is altogether unsurprising that there is no precedent for such a holding." Justice Thomas also dissented in part to the majority's opinion. Justice Thomas agreed with the majority's conclusion that a state may, consistent with the First Amendment, ban cross-burning with the intent to intimidate. However, Justice Thomas believes rather strongly that the burning of a cross is never expressive conduct protected by the First Amendment. Justice Thomas stated, and I quote, "In my view, whatever expressive value cross-burning has, the legislature simply wrote it out by banning only intimidating conduct undertaken by a particular means. A conclusion that the statute prohibiting cross-burning with the intent to intimidate speaks beyond a prohibition on certain conduct and into the zone of expression overlooks not only words, but the statute itself. Just as one cannot burn down someone's house to make a political point and then seek refuge in the First Amendment, those who hate cannot intimidate to make their own point. In light of my conclusion that the statute here addresses only conduct, there is no need to analyze the statute under any of the United States Supreme Court's First Amendment tests," end of quote. Justice Souter, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Ginsburg concurred in the judgment in part and dissented in part. Justice Souter, writing for Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, and himself, believes that Virginia's cross-burning statute did indeed make a content-based distinction within the category of punishable, intimidating, or threatening expression, and he believed that there was no legal distinction between the ordinance that the Supreme Court invalidated in RAV and the statute at issue in the Supreme Court's case that's the subject of our discussion this evening. Ultimately, the Supreme Court invalidated Barry Black's conviction and returned the other two cases of Elliott and O'Mara to the Supreme Court of Virginia. We held that the portion of the statute that created the inference was severable, and we affirmed the convictions of Elliott and O'Mara. The case of Virginia versus Black is a very interesting legal saga, and the various opinions issued by the justices of the United States Supreme Court raise numerous fascinating and intellectually stimulating legal questions. They actually, in my judgment, raise more questions than they answer. And I regret, because of our time constraints and the possibility that I may bore you, of my inability to explore these issues in greater detail. But I believe there are several lessons to be learned from this saga. The first lesson is that under the Supreme Court's First Amendment jurisprudence, a state may indeed proscribe the act of burning a cross with the intent to intimidate. Scholars will debate for some time whether the Supreme Court's opinion in Black is a departure from or an expansion of its prior First Amendment jurisprudence. Certainly, the history of cross-burning in America and the powerful message of fear of bodily harm that the cross conveys played a significant factor in the Supreme Court's decision. But as we sit here today, all of us can visualize symbols that are equally as repugnant as the burning of a cross, and these symbols also convey the fear of bodily harm or death. What symbols may a speaker, what protections may a speaker who invokes these symbols receive under the First Amendment? I think that the most troublesome aspect of Virginia versus Black is the notion that a jury instruction approved by a judge in one case can result in a statute being rendered facially invalid under the First Amendment. This precept is very troublesome. Ponder, if you will, this question. Does the legal principle articulated by the plurality authorize a state trial court judge to issue a jury instruction that will cause a statute passed by the Congress of the United States to be deemed unconstitutional under the First Amendment? The First Amendment is a truly unique American bundle of protections. As Americans, as Virginians, as judges, as lawyers, but most importantly as citizens. We believe very strongly in the First Amendment, and we believe very strongly in the protection of free speech. We also believe that our nation is made stronger by allowing what has been described as the free trade in ideas, even when we find those ideas repugnant, distasteful, and even repulsive. As Americans, we have faith that an educated and free populace will disavow hurtful, invective ideas, and that our populace will embrace meritorious ideas that promote freedom, that promote equality, and that promote liberty. And that by embracing the marketplace of ideas, our nation will become stronger, and we as a people will become stronger. Gerald Gunther made some comments at Stanford University many years ago. And he made these comments to a group of students, undergraduate students, because these students were contemplating regulating conduct of the students on Stanford's campus. And Gerald Gunther, who was one of the greatest constitutional law scholars ever, wrote, and I quote, "I received my elementary education in a public school in a very small town in Nazi Germany. There I was subjected to vehement anti-Semitic remarks from my teacher, my classmates, and others. I can assure you that those remarks hurt. More generally, I lived in a country where ideological orthodoxy reigned and where the opportunity for dissent was severely limited. The lesson I have drawn from my childhood in Nazi Germany and my happier adult life in America is the need to walk the sometimes difficult path of denouncing the bigots' hateful ideas with all my power, yet at the same time challenging any community's attempt to suppress hateful ideas by force." End of quote. We are so blessed and we are so fortunate because we live in America. I have had the wonderful experience of working with judges all around the world and working with countries as they drafted and developed constitutions. And every time I give of my time and your time, because I work for you, the taxpayers and the citizens, I marvel at how great this country is. And this country is great for a host of reasons. And among those reasons is, among those reasons are, we share common values, we share common beliefs in a set of liberties and freedoms. And those liberties and those freedoms are set forth in many documents. Some of those documents confer legal rights, and others encapsulate our beliefs. The document that most encapsulates our beliefs, that confers no legal rights, is the Declaration of Independence, authored by the founder of this great university. Because in the Declaration of Independence, we find the right to a trial by jury, the right to a trial somewhere in the area where the crime occurred, the right to freedom, the right to liberty. There are many, many rights in that basic document that I commend to you. And in Virginia's Constitution, which predates America's Constitution and which was the first Constitution to contain a Bill of Rights and which was the first Constitution to make mention to anything close to the rights found in the First Amendment, and also in our Bill of Rights, we have those rights that protect us. Our right to petition our government, our right to speak freely, our right to petition and challenge our government, our right to vote, our right to be represented, our rights to a trial by jury, our rights to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. We have a host of rights that we too often take for granted. And then you raise the question, are these rights self-executing? Sometimes they are, and sometimes they aren't. As judges, I would like to think that these rights are self-executing. But as a public servant, as a lawyer, as a citizen, I know that they are not. Because the preservation of these rights depends upon an educated populace. Unless our citizens are educated, our rights have no meaning. And that is why this lecture series is so important. And that is why people like Professor Abraham render an invaluable service to us. Because people like Professor Abraham teach us about our rights. And I cannot emphasize enough the importance of America being cognizant of her rights. And then there is the role of the judicial system. What would happen if in America we were to awaken tomorrow and just as in Pakistan, the judges were imprisoned and the courts were shut down? Upon whom would you depend to ensure that your First Amendment rights were viable? Who would stand between you and governmental tyranny? What would stand before you and governmental tyranny? We live in the greatest civilization in the history of the world. It was not by chance, and it was not by luck, because I believe not in luck. We have worked hard to develop freedoms and values and constitutional protections that we as a nation have embraced from the inception of America. And I believe it is very, very important that we undertake every effort to educate our students and our fellow Americans about the importance not only of the First Amendment, but the importance of our Bill of Rights, and the importance of lawyers, and the importance of the judiciary. Without question, a viable, strong, and independent judicial system is critical to the preservation of the First Amendment and America's Bill of Rights. I thank you very much for having the opportunity to share with you this evening, and I am just so honored and indebted to Professor Abraham, and I can say that my life has been so enriched because of my association with you. The fall of 1976, I was a student in your class. You were really my favorite professor at UVA. And I thank you for that opportunity. Thank you.
What an extraordinary experience to have been taken on an expertly guided tour, not simply of a particular case, but of the judicial process as seen from a participant and one who now happily leads the court system of our Commonwealth. I must say, I've taught the Black case a fair number of times, but I'm never going to teach it that way again. I now know things about that case. I have insights from this session that you've shared with us that just present a totally just different levels and dimensions. Just a fascinating experience, particularly for a constitutional law teacher, but I think shared by everyone. Chief Justice Hassell said he would be willing to respond to a few questions. He looks forward to chatting informally during the social hour, but if there are questions that would not cause him to go too far behind the curtain or behind the robes in regard to this case or obviously any other pending case, there may be questions about his court, his role, his perception, and of course, if he wants to tell you more about Henry's course back in the 1970s, I'm sure that would be welcome too. But we do have time for a few questions, and they would be welcome. So, if there are no initial takers, let me take the advantage of this opportunity. Normally, the U.S. Supreme Court defers to state courts in matters of U.S. constitutional law as applied to states, and we assume that state courts know their own values and traditions best. It strikes me from the way you've taken us through the case that Black may be the rare, I can't think of another one, situation in which, in a sense, the U.S. Supreme Court may better have understood the values, traditions, and needs of the Commonwealth from which the case came than did the majority of our own court. I don't know if that's maybe a rhetorical question, but it struck me that after all you'd said that there was that to it.
Well, I thought that in that respect, Black was certainly aberrational. It was different. And I think that Justice Scalia's dissent spoke better than I can ever speak to that issue. One thing I would like to do, too, if you don't mind, I want to acknowledge Dean Mahoney. I spoke with him earlier before we started, and I appreciate the wonderful job he's doing at the law school. And then there's a person here, Professor Richard Bonney. And Professor Bonney has been instrumental in helping the Virginia's court system significantly. We made tremendous improvements to Virginia's mental health statutes. And Professor Bonney has devoted his professional career to helping us improve mental health accessibility to everyone. And I drove up to Charlottesville 3 years ago and met with Professor Bonney in his classroom, and I asked him to help us improve Virginia's mental health statutes. And Professor Bonney, his immediate response was, "I'd like to do it, but I tried 20 years ago and it didn't work out." And I promised Professor Bonney we'd be successful. And we have been successful, not because of me, but because of Professor Bonney. And so I thank him very much. Are there questions? I'll take questions about almost anything. You all pay my salary. Yes. I get nervous when lawyers ask me questions.
When Black was remanded to the Virginia Supreme Court for final determination on the Elliott and O'Mara case, in light of the Supreme Court's decision, the Supreme Court, the Virginia Supreme Court, sent out a notice to the attorneys representing Mr. Black and O'Mara, essentially, as I understood it, sort of asking them what did they think the U.S. Supreme Court had said in their opinion, because, or what were the what did they view as the questions presented? Is that an unusual procedure, or was that
no
indicative of the fact that it wasn't exactly clear what the Supreme Court was saying in
that? No, I understood, and I think we all understood, but we, the question is, the United States Supreme Court invalidated Black's conviction and told him, you don't have to pay a fine and you don't have a felony on your record. Go home and we hope we don't see you again. However, with the two young men in Virginia Beach, and they were rather young, I think they were 19 and 20, but they were young. As my wife says, they were young enough to be forgiven for being stupid. And there's a lot of truth to that. Well, their two cases were remanded to the Supreme Court of Virginia, and the Supreme Court of the United States asked the Supreme Court of Virginia to discern or to determine whether the statute that talked about the prima facie case being the burning of a cross was prima facie evidence of intent to intimidate, whether that was severable, which means can you take that statute, throw it in the trash, and still apply the main statute that prohibited the cross burning, and was that consistent with Virginia's jurisprudence? And the question raised is, once the case came back from the Supreme Court of the United States to the Supreme Court of Virginia, we then sent notices to the lawyers representing these two young men. And we asked the lawyers to tell us what they thought the issues were. And the reason we did that, and we generally do that if a case comes back to us from the U.S. Supreme Court. And Virginia is a pretty interesting state because the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't hear a lot of cases. And we seem to have cases up there from time to time. I've been on the court, I'm in my 20th year, and I've written two dissents that became and that were embraced ultimately by the U.S. Supreme Court. And then I wrote an opinion that the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed with and told me pretty quickly. But I still think I'm right and they're wrong, so that's okay. But they're final, and I respect that and accept that. But we sent letters to the lawyers, as we always do, and we asked the lawyers to tell us, what do you think the issues are? Because we want to be sure that we aren't missing something. And generally, when you practice law, and I love practicing law, I love trying cases. And as a trial lawyer, if you're good at what you do, you should know more about your case than anybody in the world. And if you know more about your case than anybody in the world, when the opinion comes back, you may see issues that the judges do not see. And remember, as a judge, we are seeing 3,000 cases, my court alone, 3,000 cases a year. And as the Chief Justice, believe it or not, your court system, the Virginia court system, is the 12th largest court system in the United States. And we process more cases in Virginia alone than the entire federal judiciary combined. You take all the federal courts, the federal district courts, the federal bankruptcy courts, the federal appellate courts, you add up their cases, you add up our cases, you take the non-Article III courts, and there are more cases processed in Virginia alone. And so we see a lot of cases. And that having been said, we invited the lawyers to comment on the cases to get their perspective, and then the lawyers were allowed to file an additional round of briefing, and then the lawyers were allowed to argue a second time around. I hope that answers your question. But it is not a typical, we've only, my 20 years on the court, we probably had, that I can think of, 8 or 9 cases to come back to us from the U.S. Supreme Court. And in each of those cases, well, we've had less than that to be remanded. We probably have 4 or 5 in 20 years, but the cases that were remanded and we had additional arguments, we gave the lawyers an opportunity to weigh in regarding what the lawyers thought the issues were. Yes?
Understanding, sir, that you've been long concerned about the low remuneration that there is for court-appointed defense attorneys in Virginia. My understanding as a non-lawyer is that there was a reform of sorts a couple of years ago, but that it's not really making much of a difference. Perhaps there's too much paperwork for people to fill in, that it didn't ease things. I know you appointed a commission. What is your perspective now on what needs to be done? As a non-lawyer, to me, it's absolutely astonishing that someone can be tried for something that can be a life sentence and the lawyer can only get $1,100.
Well, we've made tremendous progress. The comment or the question relates to Virginia's method of compensating court-appointed counsel. As everyone is aware, if a person is indigent, he or she is entitled to court-appointed counsel at the taxpayer's expense if the person has a risk of incarceration, and then there are some other exceptions. If a person's liberty will be deprived, for example, if the person will be the subject of an involuntary mental health commitment. But the indigent people are entitled to counsel in most criminal cases in which they will be subject to a deprivation of liberty. Virginia was not last in the nation, but Virginia fell in the bottom third of the nation in terms of payment of counsel who represented poor people. And I don't care what anybody says, there is a correlation between how much you could, between resources and outcomes. When I practiced law, I was a defense attorney. I did not represent, I did very, very little criminal defense work. But I represented Fortune 500 companies, Fortune 100 companies. I represented all of the teaching hospitals in Virginia, including UVA's medical school, well, medical school and the medical staff. And I can tell you it makes a difference. If you have greater resources, you can plan more, you can prepare more, and you can get a better result for your client. During my tenure as Chief Justice, the General Assembly and the Governor have been just wonderful in terms of increasing compensation for lawyers who represent indigent criminal defendants. We have made tremendous strides. However, we still have many strides to make. We are not, in my judgment, where we ought to be. And we still have to do a better job of improving compensation for people who represent persons who are subject to mental health proceedings. I mean, there is a lot that needs to be done that has yet been done. In spite of that, you know, we have a very good judicial system in Virginia, but we still have areas that are in need of improvement. Yes?
You're doing a case emotionally appalling effects when you're hearing a case like that. Can you talk about how you stay above the fray and remain objective? When it might be real tempting to get attached to one side. And I don't mean this in reference to religion.
I understand.
But just generally.
The question is, when there are emotions or there are atrocious facts, how do you stay above the fray? I'd like to say easy, but that would be a lie. Believe it or not, black is an emotionally charged case. But I know that in my descent in black that I stand second to none in terms of my commitment to anybody who wants to exercise his or her First Amendment rights. Because I believe that a person has a right to burn a cross as a symbol or an expression. You just can't do it with the intent to place someone in fear of bodily harm. And as a lawyer or as a jurist, we don't protect people, we protect the rule of law, and we protect constitutional principles. And those principles, you've got to have a zealous passion, I think, to be a good jurist or to be a lawyer. But you have to protect the Constitution and not people. I've had a lot of cases in which I have been forced to ignore the equities and to ignore who should win and who should lose. And all of us, we have biases and we have predilections. And anytime you hear a judge or a judicial candidate tells you that he or she is just going to ignore the law, ignore the facts, and apply the law and apply the law zealously, and they're going to be a servant of the law, you tell them, stand beside Pinocchio and see whose nose is going to grow the longest. Be weary of judicial candidates and judges who tell you that. Don't believe them because it's not true. And it's not true because there are lots of statutes that are vague. And when I was a lawyer, I did lobbying work for certain clients, both the federal and state level. And I've discussed bills and statutes with members of Congress. And sometimes people aren't able to agree. And when people aren't able to agree, people being legislators, they say, this is the closest we can come. We agree upon these words, and we'll let the courts tell us what they mean. And that happens in every legislative body, everywhere, and that's just a part of the process. And so at some point in time, a court will be called to fill in a gap. Or the statute is poorly drafted or inartfully drafted, or the statute may be ambiguous and may have a latent ambiguity or a patent ambiguity, and a court will be called upon to decide what the statute means. So how judges think will indeed make a difference. I try as best I can to apply the law as written by the legislature, to apply the constitutional provision as best I can, and not yield to emotions. But sometimes we do yield to emotions. I mean, I've written opinions and I hated the outcome. And I've turned to my colleagues at the end of the day, because we write for a court. And on an appellate court, whoever has the opinion is a choir director. If you don't have four votes, you don't write for the majority. It's as simple as that. And so as the writer for the court, I have to blend at least four voices. Four voices equals four votes, and four votes equals a majority. Anything over four is gravy on your mashed potatoes. But if you don't have four, you don't get the mashed potatoes. You get the dissent. And so we are writing for a group. And sometimes when you write for the group, you don't like what you've written. And I've written opinions, and I've said, how on earth did I write that? But I did not write for me. I wrote for one of four, or one of seven. And that makes a difference. That makes a big difference. I mean, we are bound to apply the law, and sometimes the law is not equitable, but it's the law. And you don't want to make exceptions. And Black is a very good illustration, because Justice Souter, writing for the three dissenters, he believed that in Black, the majority was making an exception because of the powerful and offensive symbol or message that a cross, a burning cross, sends. And he believed, as did the majority on my court, that the statute violated the First Amendment because it regulated protected speech. And the center so believed, because the center filed briefs in my court and also in the court of the United States, the United States Supreme Court, arguing that the conduct was permissible conduct, and that the conduct wasn't permissible, but the statute was invalid. I mean, and everybody agreed too in all of these cases. Well, that's not true. It would not have been true in the Black case, but in the O'Mara case and the Elliott case, the kids were guilty of trespass. They were also guilty of burning a fire in a city in violation of a bunch of other ordinances. And so those kids would have been subjected to other criminal penalties. But not so with Mr. Black, because he was burning a cross on private property. I hope I answered your question in a very convoluted answer.
Thank you.
Thank you.